Our kids are in trouble. What can you do to help? Come hear Andrew McPeak speak at the 11th annual RUC fundraising banquet at the Villa Milano on March 6th. Make your reservations now at relationshipsunderconstruction.com.
Do you ever get tired of winning? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Hey, I'm glad to be back with you, Barry, on this we're recording this on Thursday. It is nasty here. I don't know what it's doing down there, but we've got freezing drizzle here. It's freezing as it hits the ground, but it's not too bad on the roads.
No, we're just kind of overcast right now. It hasn't started in on anything yet, so we're supposed to be getting more rain today than anything, and then possibly tomorrow we get some of the snow and the gunk. So,
well, I'll be not too far from where you are as I head south. I'm going on vacation.
Good for you.
And Jenny and I will be driving. Now, normally when we go down, we go through from this part of Ohio. We'll drive down 33 all the way to 77 and then go down that way. Cause we're talking about stopping in, well, maybe in Charleston someplace, not Charleston,
sure.
West Virginia, but Charleston, South Carolina.
Carolina.
We could go spend a couple of days in Charleston, West Virginia, but I'm not really sure. You know, we could go up and look at the airport and look at the pictures of how they took the tops off the mountains to create the most dangerous airport in the world, or very close to it, it seems like. Or we can go to Charleston, South Carolina, and you know, maybe go to the Fort Sumter Museum. We talked about maybe taking the ferry out to the fort, that kind of stuff.
But if you don't go to Charleston, West Virginia, you don't get to see a state capitol whose dome is gilt in gold.
It's gold leaf, yeah. It's gold foil. It is an amazing thing. Just goes to show you that there is more money in West Virginia than people think.
Right.
But it's concentrated in it's an interesting because it's a resource. Place. Although West Virginia is changing economically, has been for several decades, and Barack Obama wanted to see it change permanently by closing all the coal mines. And what do you know? Donald Trump managed to open up a few of those mines again.
Yes, he did.
And you know, this silly idea that we should stop burning coal for electricity and that kind of thing, and for steam production. Hey folks, guess what? We live in the 21st century, and there is technology, scrubber technology now that lets you take virtually all the sulfur out, all the particulates out of the smoke and most of the CO2. So basically what you get out of these things nowadays, the smokestacks everybody's crying about is steam.
True. That's exactly what it is.
Now, by not allowing some coal-fired plants to open back up, the EPA has basically said, we don't want this modern technology, and we don't want this energy source, which is an absurdity. Wow, we kind of went right back into it today, didn't we? Instead of our usual banter, but again, we live in the 21st century, and we have the ability to make the emissions from those coal-burning plants very clean, very, very clean.
And oh, absolutely. You know, and we have ultimately more sources that can help us to, stay energy independent. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you saw it or not, and I want to talk more in depth about it a little bit later. But during the State of the Union address that happened earlier this week, the president, you know, made a clear point about how we are now a net exporter of oil and gas because we have revitalized so many other energy sources like coal, like nuclear, That we don't have to be as dependent upon foreign oil sources as we've had in the past under previous administrations, and especially not the most previous administration, whose focus was more toward sending money toward wind and solar energies, which, although they sound sexy and environmentally sound, actually are just a money pit. As you and I have talked before, and you know, we've both looked into it, when you talk about some of these wind turbines, they take longer to basically repay themselves in the energy that they generate than they ever will be able to, because the cost of the technology is so expensive.
It's close to the same with solar cells. Essentially, you have to put more energy into a solar cell to create it than you will ever actually eke out of it, because people talk about the lifespan of a solar cell. Well, it hits a peak at about a year or two, and then the output of those things steadily drops off. So while you can put them up, the payback, let's say it has a 25-year life, and I think that's about right, the payback for those units, because they're still grossly expensive, is in the 18-year range?
Well, no, what I've heard, this is my understanding, was that the average replacement life on those wind turbines, and that's for the blades, et cetera, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 17, 18 years, but the payback period is 24.
Yeah, well, that could be
before they generate enough in order to actually pay for the cost. So if you start thinking about that, and you start thinking that, okay, you got these huge, massive wind turbines, they've got the big, long blades, which we are now finding are absolutely impossible to recycle. And so now they're having the ones that are that crack or have worn out or are structurally problematic. Have to be then hauled off to landfills that are willing to take them, because they also are made of materials that don't decompose.
They're toxic. Yeah,
and they're toxic. So you got a toxic substance that can't be recycled into anything else, that has to be replaced about every 17 or 18 years because of wear and stress on those veins, that they can't hold up to it. They're inordinately expensive. I don't know exactly. I haven't seen a cost price list, but I have heard that that particular type of vane is hugely expensive. And I mean, because once they manufacture them, then they have to get like the extra long semis with the extra a cart on the back, because they're so long, to haul them to wherever the turbine is to put up. And so you've got all that, the shipping costs and expense, the production costs, the expense, and then the installation costs. And by the time it gets back up and gets going again, you're basically looking at, you never are going to recoup your initial investments.
Well,
on wind energy. So, but that was what the previous administration dumped billions of dollars into and tried to kill the coal industry and the nuclear industry. Funny how 3 years can make such a difference, Chuck.
Well, absolutely, Barry. And we didn't – one of the roads that we had to energy independence that was being laid out by, well, by the radical left, and that includes former President Obama, was not using as much by essentially shutting down industry.
Yep. I mean,
the fact is that right. one of the methods they were going to use in this globalization push, that was a big thing, not just of Barack Obama, but of George W. Bush, of Bill Clinton, of George H.W. Bush, before him, this globalization push was to move heavy industry out and put it in places at the behest of corporations where people could be paid less and in so doing, we were gonna reduce our energy dependence, and we were going
Wait a minute. People should be paid less. Don't they get $15 an hour minimum wage too?
No, they don't.
Okay.
Yeah. we hear about these, the Asian powerhouses. Well, the Asian powerhouses are powerhouses because they sell Americans' goods made in sweatshops where people just aren't paid that much. And, you know, Americans like their stuff. Well, one of the big complaints, for instance, about iPhones, where are they made? They're made in China. Are people making American-sized wages in China, electronic workers, to do this? No, they're making a fraction of what American workers would make to build those things, and their sweatshops on top of that. And Apple's been rightly criticized for that, as have, you know, for instance, I carry a Samsung phone. Well, Samsung is, if I'm not mistaken, a Korean company. And it's made in Korea by Koreans. Well, would you expect necessarily that if it's made in Korea by Koreans, that they would have the same pay scales as they would in the United States? But where is Apple located? What is Apple's big headquarters and its founding? Where was that? It was in California, in the United States of America.
I always forget which one was in Washington State and which one was in California. So
Washington State's Microsoft.
Microsoft, yeah, that's right. Microsoft was up in Washington.
Right. But it's that whole, you know, so to make maximum money, let's build our Apple equipment in China.
Of course.
That's the way we were going to clean up the environment. We were basically going to slough off our dirty industry off in China. Now, one of the reasons that globalized companies really wanted to do things in Asia, especially China, was relaxed environmental regulations.
Woohoo!
Yeah, which is exactly what we've been talking about. So, now, what's Donald Trump doing about that? He's making it easier now to run your business here. By reducing regulations, is he necessarily reducing environmental regulations? No, but there are some environmental regulations that are so unbearably stupid and nonsensical and really unattainable that it's no wonder companies want to move out. Beyond the profit margin, they can't comply. I'm in a highly regulated business, no matter what you may hear about the dietary supplement industry. We are highly regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. By the way, when pundits come on and tell you that we're an unregulated business, what they mean is the FDA cannot dictate to us how many pieces of toilet paper we may use when we're finished in the water closet. Because in the pharmaceutical industry where I've also worked, you're pretty almost that bad. I basically have to sit around and fill out paperwork. About a third of my day is sitting around filling out paperwork that nobody will ever look at. If something, quote unquote, something ever happens, they'll have that to come and look at. Okay, fine, whatever. That is what people are leaving the United States to escape, and that's what Donald Trump has been busy dismantling. As a businessman, he knows. Remember, he built buildings in one of the most regulated cities in America, if not the world, and that's New York City. This is why guys like Bloomberg and de Blasio really hated Donald Trump because he knew how to get around the regulatory aspects and succeed in the real estate market. I will not kid you that Donald Trump didn't have to declare bankruptcy a couple times. He did. And for what reason? Well, sometimes you get overextended. You make a bet and you get overextended. And then once you're overextended, you have to retrench.
Yes, you do. Absolutely.
And a lot of times, you know, Donald Trump didn't liquidate, which is a lot, what some people are, you know, oh, he scammed his creditors. No, he paid off his creditors. He did a structured bankruptcy, which means you pay back your creditors. They may not get as much interest as they necessarily would have. Nonetheless, they get paid back. That's the kind of bankruptcy. Now, there are people that for a while in America, people would run up $40,000 in credit card debt and then run off and declare bankruptcy. And that became much harder in the 2000s, which is not really where we want to go. But we, you know, this is about, you know, what Trump has done to, dismantle these ideas that somehow we had to do more with less and that we had to shut things down. And it's not a bad thing to conserve, but it's a bad thing to conserve to the point where you are hurting the economy. And if you remember, you're old enough to remember Jimmy Carter.
Oh, absolutely.
Jimmy Carter's big thing in the 70s, remember during the energy crisis, we have to learn to do more with less, and the days of the American dream where you owned your own home and lived on your own plot of land with your own individual house are all coming to an end. That was his big mantra. He actually said that. What did the left want us to do? They wanted to herd us all into multifamily units in urban centers.
Yep, that's exactly where they wanted to go.
And very interestingly, it's merely the exact opposite of what happened in Cambodia just a few years earlier, where they herded everybody out of the cities and onto the land. And what that did was they ended up killing a huge percentage of the population.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. And you have these things going on. I mean, it's just, again, I'm looking at this whole thing, Chuck, you know, and we talk about, you know, our energy issues. That is a huge thing. You know, when the president talked about that during the State of the Union, that we are now a net exporter of energy, that is actually a major step in the right direction toward America retaining its sovereignty. Because if you're not at the mercy of some other country who may have dictators, et cetera, or who can basically bring you to your knees economically by just refusing to sell you oil or other energy sources, you really don't have any control in your country. But if you are in a position where, you know, you're encouraging exploration, you're encouraging development, you're encouraging production of energy, and you have done so in such a way that you now have become a supplier instead of a recipient of energy, to, you know, your net exports are greater than your net imports. You are well on your way back to strengthening the sovereignty of your country in relation to so many other areas, geopolitically, whether it be in negotiations of peace treaties or tariff agreements or trade agreements, or if it is just the idea that you're strong enough that, you know, certain players will maybe think twice before they try to create an issue with your country. But, you know, we know some of these dictatorial nations like to rattle the sword every once in a while, a la the mouse that roared, in order to see if they can't, you know, by rattling chains and waving swords, put enough doubt into people's minds that the easy answer is to placate them by paying them off with some payments. I don't know, maybe like $150 million in $100 bills. You know, who knows?
Well, or more like what we paid Iran, which was, I think, $150
billion. It was $150 billion. You see, I was going to see if you caught that.
Yes.
I just threw that million out there because I knew what it was.
For those of you,
I just wanted to see for purposes of, under the previous administration, we handed Iran, a nation that has rarely ever been a ally of the United States in any real form, and the CIA propped dictators of the past, no exception there. But we handed them $150 billion in cash, Why did we do that? Because with the policies of our previous administration, we were a debtor nation when it came to energy. And Iran is one of the pipeline areas of chokehold on the oil and gas that the American people need in order to maintain our standard of living and run our businesses and, you know, keep our families safe and secure and do other things of that nature. But it was being sold away. And, of course, you know, when they started making noises, all of a sudden our government through the Obama administration sent plane loads of cash to them. Yeah. What do they do with this cash, Chuck? Oh, that is Soleimani and company go and they create foment and try to take over the U.S. embassy. Well, funny thing is, I bet it didn't cost quite $150 billion, but I believe that the remote-controlled missile strike that ended Soleimani's threat from the Trump administration didn't cost quite $150 billion.
Oh, no. Oh, gosh, no. It probably cost a few tens of thousands of dollars. It was a drone. It was a remote drone missile strike. So it wasn't that expensive. But think about this, Barry. Mm-hmm. That $150 billion was supposed to pay off Iran to get to bail out of its nuclear weapons development program. Did they actually do it? Now, let's be clear about that money. What was the excuse about returning that to giving that money to Iran? It was theirs anyway. It was frozen assets. That was the mantra.
Aha. Uh-huh.
It was frozen assets, and the judge said we had to return it. Barry, that's a policy thing. And that judge, yeah. People had been saying that we had to give that money back for decades. That money had been being held since 1979.
Yes, it was. And gee, what happened in 1979, Chuck, that made us hold their money?
Yeah, they took over the American embassy and held hostages for 444 days.
That's right. And basically then as soon as we gave them the money back, or, you know, within a couple of years of giving the money back, what did they try to do again?
They tried to take over an American embassy, this time in Baghdad.
That's right. Some things never change.
That's right. Some things never change. So basically we bribed them and we sweetened the pot. We threw in more money than just the $150 billion. So basically Barack Obama said, let's pay protection. Let's pay protection money. What happens when you pay a bad guy protection money?
Well, they find other ways to threaten you that you will have to continue to pay them or pay them more.
Yeah. The guy, the knee breaker comes around and says, hey, you're not giving enough. We need more money. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been protecting your business and you're not paying enough. Pardon me.
And you know what? And when a bully threatens you like that, you can do two things. You can either capitulate to the bully and the bullying will continue on, or pop the bully right in the nose and you get him to go away. Barack Obama's administration took the former route. Donald Trump's administration took the latter route. Which one do you think is more effective?
Well, obviously the one that's more effective is Trump's approach, and you'll notice that we're not at war with Iran. And one thing I want to bring up, you know, we've had this. John Bolton is now out there stirring the pot, basically to sell books. John Bolton is stirring the pot basically because he got fired. He got fired from a job he never should have had. He was brought in by a chief of staff who was really not a Trump guy. Trump attempted to appease the never Trumpers.
Yes,
by bringing in these swamp rats. He said, well, maybe I can bring them in and convert them and, you know, keep an eye on them. Well, that didn't work out. And you'll see, you got a John Bolton. I can remember a close friend of mine who a Vietnam vet and he's a very good guy and he's a solid thinker, but he said, I really like John Bolton. I go, you need to examine his record. He's a saber rattler extraordinaire. And if we did what John Bolton wanted, we'd be at war in about 20 countries right now. And what did Trump recently say? He was asked about John Bolton after this stuff came out. He was asked about John Bolton, and all these people were talking about how much they respected John Bolton for this and that and another thing that he'd done. And what did Trump say? Trump said, if I'd listened to John Bolton, we'd be in World War VI by now.
Yeah, absolutely.
And because he's not lying, John Bolton's big plan for everything was send ground troops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, absolutely.
So Trump instead has given these guys a slap that he knew that they would feel to their core, and he said, you want more? And what did Iran immediately do? Well, they launched some missiles that were totally ineffective, badly done, and totally missed the target. Some Americans were injured, but they were not. No one was killed. You know, they got concussion injuries from the explosions and that kind of thing. But no one was actually. No one got any shrapnel or anything because they knew the missiles were coming. So what did they do? After that, they sort of sued for peace. They're like, yeah, we need to back away from this. Can we talk?
Yeah.
That's not the sign that somebody fears doesn't fear you. When someone comes to you after they've gotten a bloody nose and punched back ineffectively, what are they? Oh, can't we be friends?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, we really didn't mean that.
Right. We're just kidding. This is the kind of stuff that Trump does, and he does it well because he's willing to take a measured response. If you'll recall, the Iranians shot down an American drone over the Gulf of Aqaba.
Yes, they did.
And what did John Bolton immediately say? Okay, that's it. Send in the Air Force.
Oh, yeah. He wanted to basically go in and, like, create a war.
Yeah, he wanted to go in and you know, grossly overdo the response. And what did Trump do? He was thinking about it because he alerted the Air Force to prepare for that. And then he said, wait a minute. How many people are, how many civilians who had nothing to do with this are going to be killed? And they said, oh, 150 or 200. He said, that's 150 or 200 too many.
Yep.
Our aim is to strike military targets and bad players inside. So he called it off. Bolton was livid.
Of course, and, yeah. John Bolton was about to get his war that he wanted.
That's right.
Trump shut him off.
That's right. And so were a bunch of the chicken hawks. As I recall, people are sort of soft on Lindsey Graham these days. Lindsey Graham was, I think this is a bad decision. All these guys who are all for sending American troops without actually putting on the uniform themselves and putting on their boots and taking up a rifle and going and doing it and sitting in the trenches while these young people are killed and wounded and messed up for life. They were all, oh, no, I think this is a bad policy decision. Well, of course you do, because you didn't get your war. That's
right.
That's the problem. And Barry, I one thing I want to bring up, because this leads me to a spot where we were going to go anyway, and that's the impeachment. What's the impeachment about? It's about a grossly different view of how government policy should work. This is why you've got a guy like Pierre Delecto, Mitt Romney, claiming that he saw some kind of crime committed that was worthy of removal from office. That because Mitt Romney has a view of how government policy should work, these people want to remote control, implement a globalist policy. And they want to do it through bureaucrats that are entrenched in the system. This is why you're getting these goofy leaks out of the National Security Agency, even from people who are employed in the White House, if you don't understand that. These people are career bureaucrats. They're there because the National Security Agency has sent them. It's not because Trump wanted them there. It's because the NSA sent them. CIA, same thing. These people are entrenched. They have a globalist worldview and a globalist mindset, and they are there to undermine a nationalist policy. And by nationalist policy, I mean what's good for the United States of America, not necessarily for the United States of America as the quote-unquote leader of the free world. Trump's idea of leading the free world is to lead by example. The globalist idea of the leadership of America is to have America be the person who dictates policy to other countries through this hegemonist interlocking agreements that will do nothing eventually except set up across the world spheres of influence that will be constantly at war with one another. Yep. Now, if you want a picture of that, read 1984. There are three world powers. There's Oceania, Eurasia, and East Asia. And they represent, and what are they fighting over in the book? Do you remember what the bone of contention in the book was?
No, I forget.
It was the continent of Africa. They were all fighting each other, with the bone of contention being the continent of Africa.
Oh, okay.
Not sure. It had something to do with some resources that were available there. But that's what, and the wars essentially are phony. If you recall, the announcement over the telescreen, we are now at war with East Asia. We've always been at war with East Asia. Eurasia has always been our ally. Well, everybody knew that was false. But when you have real think, you can convince people that they're your allies and always have been. You brought up another movie reference. We just did a book reference. You did a movie reference earlier, The Mouse That Roared. A lot of people will go, what is that? Folks, if you don't know what The Mouse That Roared is, it's one of the funniest movies you'll ever see.
Absolutely is.
Made in the 60s. It was Peter Sellers was a Peter Sellers movie, essentially. It was about a small country named the Grand Duchy of Fenwick. The Duchy of Grand Fenwick.
Of Grand Fenwick, that's right. I always get that wrong. I always mix that up.
The Duchy of Grand Fenwick, and they're like broke, and they've got no tourists, and they've got they have no money in the coffers, so they look at the American reparations in Europe after World War II and how much, you know, the Marshall Plan and all that stuff about rebuilding Europe after World War II. And they say, you know, we can get in on this action.
Yep.
And somebody says, well, how can we do it? We declare war on the United States. We invade, and then they come back and counter invade, and then they beat us in a war, and then they'll rebuild the country. This was their big plan. What they do is they accidentally, they invade, they send these, these little boats in with these guys with like, the battle axes. I'm trying to think of the name of the thing with the it's got a pike on one end and an axe.
The halberd.
And these guys get out of the boat with these things, and they accidentally capture this guy who's developed some nuclear bomb, this Q bomb. And so, there's a big panic because these invaders have captured this scientist. They don't want anything to do with the Q bomb. All they want to do is get defeated in a war so they can get some money. So the whole thing is hilarious. And if you can find a copy, look, old movies are out every place. You can find it. It's called The Mouse That Roared. Go look at it. But it plays into this. It plays into this idea, that we've just watched Britain bail out of the common market, or out of the European Union, not necessarily out of the common market. Why? Because essentially they were being run internally from Brussels, Belgium.
Yes, they were.
Brussels was essentially taking over and making the British Parliament more and more and more irrelevant and taking more and more and more of their money and stealing their fisheries and doing all this. And finally, they said, we've had enough. That's enough. I personally think that that was the opening shot in the unraveling of the European Union. And so those of you who thought the EU was going to be the Antichrist base and all that stuff, well, it's yet to be played out, but it's looking like, nope, not so much. But these are worldview issues, Barry. That's one of the things we do on this program. We talk about worldview issues. And the fact is that what you have just seen played out in the impeachment was a difference in worldviews and a difference on how policy should be implemented. If you look at the bottom line on the impeachment, what was Donald Trump in trouble for? For running policy his way. The fact is that call to the Ukrainian president was essentially the implementation of a 1999 treaty where when there's fraud in either the Ukrainian side of the equation or the American side of the equation and it's discovered, we can ask the other country to cooperate in investigations of fraud.
Yes, absolutely.
Was Hunter Biden receiving a sinecure? And if you don't know what a sinecure is, it's a job in which you do nothing but receive a substantial paycheck. He received a sinecure at the behest of his father, who was Vice President of the United States, and was being looked at in the Ukraine during the reign of Barack Obama. And Joseph Biden, the Vice President of the United States, threatened the Ukraine with foreign aid and said, if you don't call this prosecutor off, and in fact fire the prosecutor that's looking into my son's sinecure, you will not get your whatever. I forget how much the military aid was. It was several billion dollars in foreign aid. And he said, you have 6 hours. Well, the prosecutor that was looking into the sinecure was fired, and they got their money. This is exactly what they were accusing Donald Trump of having done. Now, the fact is that Joe Biden is trying to spin it because he can't deny it. There is a recording of him telling this story in front of the Council on Foreign Relations, a globalist think tank in Washington which supplies a lot of the bureaucrats that the CIA and the National Security Agency and the FBI and a number of these law enforcement agents, they have a lot of these people, especially in the upper echelons, have membership in the Council on Foreign Relations. Mitt Romney has a lot of CFR surrounding.
It isn't just CFR surrounding, Chuck. One of the things that came out during this whole investigation around this Ukrainian issue was that not only did Joe Biden have a child, Hunter, who was on the board of this Burisma and making lots and lots of money for doing nothing, Nancy Pelosi had a son who's on the board of Burisma, who's getting paid lots and lots of money for doing nothing. John Kerry, the former United States Secretary of State, had a child.
A stepson. It was Teresa Hunt. Yeah.
Making lots and lots of money for doing nothing. And surprise, 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 one Mitt Romney has a son who is on the board of the Ukrainian oil and gas company Burisma, who is making tons and tons of money for basically doing nothing. And gee, who was the only Republican who voted to remove the president from office on Wednesday? Yes, that's right. It's not a hard connect the dots here. Mitt Romney. Because Trump staying in office means that an investigation will still be continuing with what happened in the Ukraine, and that might actually implicate certain individuals, both private and public, in colluding against the interests of the United States. Chuck, if anybody is going to go to jail over this or be removed from their office, it's more likely going to be Mitt Romney than Donald Trump.
It should be, but it won't be. Honestly, it should be, but it won't be.
We'll see. We'll see. Again, here's the big issue. Everybody was trying to get this done, from Nancy Pelosi to Schiff and company to the Never Trumpers in the Senate, because they understand that if Trump wins re-election, which is, I would say, if you were putting Las Vegas odds on it, it's a sure bet. When Trump wins re-election, there will be four more years of systemic change happening in Washington, D.C. And at some point, that systemic change is going to start flushing out a lot of the things that are in the cracks and crevices that will then have to be addressed by the Justice Department.
Well, think about this, Barry. While the impeachment acquittal was going on, a lot of people don't know this, Jerry Nadler was running essentially a quote unquote oversight hearing on the FBI with the FBI Director Wray.
Okay.
Wray, came out in the hearing, had sent a number of people, from the FBI who had been, involved in the FISA abuse. And abuse is not strong enough. FISA fraud. They defrauded the FISA court, the whole Russiagate thing that started this whole mess was a fraud, and the FBI was involved because they had committed fraud in testifying to the fact that this was all true. Those people have been sent off, quote unquote, for discipline. Well, okay, that's fine. If that's supposed to assuage my bad feelings, it doesn't. They need more than discipline. The discipline they need is to be prosecuted, permanently removed from the FBI, and jail time. But nonetheless,
what do we think?
This stuff is beginning to play out. It's turning out. Remember the IG report where we said, "Yeah, we found wrongdoing, but it didn't rise to the level of, you know, blah blah blah." And the inspector general turns out to be cronies with all the people that he basically gave a pass to. Remember, conservatives were waiting and waiting and waiting for the IG report, and the IG report said everything we thought it was going to say, but the recommendation was for nothing. Now there's another report going to come out this summer. What's going to happen with that? It's looking into the FBI, the National Security Agency, the Director of National Intelligence, all these guys. What's going to happen with that? Well, Barry, the mood out there is not friendly to this right now. And when I'm not friendly to not giving these guys some kind of bad consequences, like James Comey. Why James Comey isn't in jail? I mean, he's admitted to violating federal law.
Yeah, he has.
He has paid no fine, and he has had no jail time. There's something wrong with this. All his friends have rallied around him. Oh, it was just poor judgment and blah, blah, blah. The man was head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You can't have people with such spectacularly bad judgment. You can't have them do these things and get away scot-free. Think about it. Why do you do public executions in the days when we used to do public executions? What's the argument against public executions? Well, they turned into, you know, picnics, and people went out to see it, and it was entertainment and blah, blah, blah. No. You do public execution so people can look on it and say, that's what happens when you commit these crimes. When you do it in a deep, dark dungeon and nobody can see it and that kind of thing, nobody gets to see the electricity pass through someone. I'm not saying I'd like to see that. What I'm saying is it may be necessary for society to look upon that so they know that that's what happens. That's why you do public executions. That's why you publicly punish people. Now, in this case, you publicly punish them by fining them in a damaging way. You don't let them collect their federal pensions, for crying out loud, Barry. You don't let them.
Come on, why not?
Yeah, you don't let them collect their federal pensions. You don't. You make them go to jail and do real time. I'm not talking about it. Look, these guys, they don't go to Lewisburg, right? They go to a federal facility where, you know, they're restricted in their movements. They still have. It's a lot better place than somebody who does armed robberies goes to. Nonetheless, they should be incarcerated. They should be on restricted movement. They should not be able to go home and be with their families. Why? They broke the law, and they broke one of the most fundamental laws. They stole people's liberty. They worked, conspired to ruin people's reputations. They work to bring destroy an election or bring an elected person down. They need to be in jail. They need to be fined, and they need to be off the federal payroll. I don't know how else to put it. Now, what does Mitt Romney need? Mitt Romney needs to be recalled. I don't think Utah currently has a recall, mechanism. I'm hearing that they have introduced one. What does that tell you? There is popular support in Utah to force him out. There is now, here's one of the problems. There is talk of expelling him from the Republican Party. Well, whatever. But who's the current head of the Republican Party?
That would be his niece, I believe.
His niece is the current head of the National Republican Party. Now, she has come out and said, Mitt is way wrong on this. I disagree with him most of the time, and I continue to disagree with him. But guess what? She's not going to be complicit in removing Uncle Mitt from the party. And then what would happen? Look, I've seen predictions already. I'm not making this prediction myself. I've seen predictions already. First of all, people are saying flat out that Mitt Romney is so mad that Donald Trump got elected to the office and he didn't. He cannot understand how someone like Donald Trump got elected and he didn't, which means he completely doesn't understand the electorate, especially the Republican Party base. That shouldn't shock anybody. We all saw what happened to his presidential campaign. It crashed and burned because he didn't understand how any of this works. Okay? Now, that being said, Mitt, it's being predicted, and I wouldn't be surprised to see this in the coming summer, in the around springtime, maybe June. Mitt Romney announces that he has to. It's as a matter of conscience and as a matter of obedience to God, he has to run for president as an independent. Now, who would be Mitt's running mate? Well, since Mitt's a quote-unquote moderate, and they're going for that middle ground, he's going to see if he can't find a moderate, disaffected Democrat. And by the way, by the middle of summer, there, I think, will be a lot of disaffected moderate Democrats, because who's going to be the nominee most likely?
Well, it's either, well, nobody knows right now because, well, Monday's Iowa caucuses still haven't been determined here on Thursday when we're recording this.
But who got the most popular votes in Iowa?
Pete Buttigieg.
No.
No, he's leading in delegates.
But the
popular vote winner, which is important to the Democratic Party, I'd have to remind them, is Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders is also going to do well in New Hampshire. He's going to have momentum going into South Carolina. Who's not going to be the nominee? Probably not Joe Biden. Now, the Democrats are scrambling to try to steal this from Bernie Sanders. Why? Because they know that with an ultra-radical as the candidate, that the Democratic Party is going to go down. Again, Barry, you're old enough to remember this, I think. 1972. Are you old enough to remember 72, the election?
Well, I was pretty sort young, of. But I was into politics from a very young age, so yes.
Who was the nominee?
For the Republicans?
No, for the Democrats.
Oh, for the Democrats, it was McGovern?
George McGovern.
George McGovern,
probably the most liberal man in the Senate at the time.
Right.
George McGovern, by the way, at this point would look like a moderate, a raving moderate, probably too far right.
Yep.
Nonetheless, and George McGovern went down ugly. He did not even take his home state. I think he won D.C. and maybe Minnesota, maybe.
Oh, so basically,
oh, Massachusetts.
The same states that Walter Mondale won against
right.
Reagan.
Well, Minnesota was understandable because that was his home state.
Well, yeah, of course.
Nonetheless, what'll happen is that it'll probably be Bernie. And now, here's my guess, Barry, and you and I've talked about this before. Who will Bernie pick? Because he's 100 years old, and he knows it, and he's good for one term. Who do you think Bernie would pick to be his running mate?
Oh, that's a good question.
I'll tell you, there's somebody who meets all the criteria. Minority woman, the whole thing. Articulate. Tulsi.
Well, she was a delegate for him 4 years ago.
Exactly. She's a Bernie guy. She's attractive. She's articulate. She's young. She's 38 years old. Bernie will be 79 or 80 if he took the oath of office. So Bernie, and he's had a heart attack. So if he dies, who's going to step in? Someone who he knows is already down with the program. Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi is also, all you got to do is go out and have a look on the blogs and look at the conservative reaction to Tulsi. They don't really understand what her motivating factors are. If you go out and look, Tulsi is acceptable, or at least not considered. There's not that much negative about Tulsi out there floating around. The only place that is negatives is in the Hillary Clinton wing of the Democratic Party.
Right.
Who's about to get handed their walking papers. So my point was that there will be moderate Democrats available to run as a quote-unquote national ticket. In other words, a Republican and a Democrat in a third party. In a third party run. And the idea being that they would steal votes from both sides. Where are they most likely to steal votes from? With a moderate ticket.
That's a good question, because this is going to be an election where I don't think the standard rules of engagement are going to apply.
I think they draw more from the Democrats personally.
Most likely, yes. You know, you would think that they would draw from the disaffected Republicans, but honestly, I think what's going to happen is that Trump is going to be drawing from the blue-collar Democrats. It looks like he's going to be drawing a significant percentage from minority populations, and if that ticket draws from the moderate Democrats, I don't see the Democratic Party having a chance of actually even coming close to winning.
Never make predictions so far in advance. You know, there's an old saying, never make predictions so far in advance. But right now, unless something really, really, really drastic happens, it's going to be Trump versus somebody radical left, which almost guarantees a Trump victory. And with a possible third party. I think, honestly, a probable third party. So keep an eye open for that. Third party with an attempt to snatch away the quote-unquote moderate vote. And you'll get guys, you'll get Republican globalists who will jump on the bandwagon for Mitt. blah, blah, blah. There will be a lot of money that goes into Mitt's campaign, including his own, because he's got more money than Croesus. We'll hear about how it's close, it's close, it's close. It's going to be like 92 with, if you remember, H.W. Bush, Clinton, and Jug Ears. Oh gosh, you know you know who I mean. Can't think of his name. He just died here last year.
Ross Perot.
Ross Perot.
Ross. Yeah, Perot. No, not a Perot. You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Ross Perot.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. They may try to make it into that. Well, Ross Perot was supposedly in there. It's the same kind of scenario. People are completely disaffected with H.W. Bush. They weren't going to vote for him again. Flat out, he's a liar. You know, remember, read my lips, no new taxes. Oh, I've tried my hardest, and I can't come up with any other way other than to raise taxes. Well, okay, fine. And so people wouldn't vote for him. And so what they do, Ross Perot, a lifelong Democrat and a contributor to Clinton, came out and ran as a quote-unquote populist, espousing sort of this vaguely conservative values that George H.W. Bush couldn't bring himself to utter. And what did he do? He drew off enough votes to give Bill Clinton the win. I think Bill Clinton got 43% of the vote. And Ross Perot did okay. Right. I forget what percentage he pulled, but he pulled mostly from the Republicans. And that's why
I think he pulled like 17 or 18%, if I remember correctly.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, something like that. And so that's for the scenario to look for. I think, though, this time they'll draw votes from the Democrats who really can't bring themselves to vote for some far-left radical. At least that's what it looks like to me. Well, Barry, we've got about a minute left.
Right. Well, again, Trump's on a roll. He just won the Iowa caucuses on Monday with 97% of the Republican vote, with what they consider to be record turnout, where the Dems can't even figure out who's winning yet.
Barry, they had had very close to a record low turnout on the Dem side.
A record low turnout on the Dem side. So there's some good things. Then you walked into, coming into later in the week, and Trump's gives a great State of the Union speech on Tuesday, one of the best that many people said they've ever heard, hitting some really key points and, really pumping up the idea that America is getting back to where it should be. Wednesday, he is acquitted of both of the impeachment charges by the Senate, with a fairly significant vote, even though Mitt Romney decided to be, an idiot and go the other way. The question is Trump tired of winning yet? Because
Trump's never tired of winning.
this is his big win week. So I'm trying. Now, the national prayer breakfast was this morning in D.C., and I think Mike Pence was at it. But I'm just kind of wondering, Chuck, between now when we're recording and Saturday when people are hearing it, how many more wins is Trump going to put on the ledger from today until Saturday? Because this is a big win week for him.
I think that the president actually addressed the national prayer breakfast. I don't know if he was there, but I think he addressed. That's a good question. Now, we are out of time. And I do want to encourage people, please go to relationshipsunderconstruction.com. That's relationshipsunderconstruction.com. And sign up to come and be at the banquet. If you want to be on my table, say that when you sign up. If you, Barry can't be there, but I'm going to be there. And if Barry gets a table, I'll be watching his table. And again, relationshipsunderconstruction.com. It's March 6th at 6:30 at the Villa Milano in Columbus on Schrock Road. Please come and join me and help us raise funds for a great cause. That's www.relationshipsunderconstruction.com. And we are out of time, so you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.
Our kids are in trouble. What can you do to help? Come hear Andrew McPeak speak at the 11th annual RUC fundraising banquet at the Villa Milano on March 6th. Make your reservations now at relationshipsunderconstruction.com.